everything except a cot, and left there alone. 2 hours after he'd been tossed into his cell, the guards returned with his clothing. They watched him dress, then marched him out and along a corridor to a hatch marked with alien symbols. They nudged him inside and piled in behind him, and a minute later, they were off. The shuttle had no viewports, giving him no clue as to where they were going, but when the hatch opened again, it was to a double row of Vagari soldiers in fancier uniform armor than his captors. He'd expected to be taken someplace small and cramped and anonymous, as befit a proper interrogation. It was therefore a shock when the final blast door opened into a large chamber that rivaled the most elaborate groundside throne rooms he'd ever seen. Against the back wall was a raised dais with an exquisitely decorated chair in the center, occupied by a Vagari clad in a heavy-looking multicolored robe with sunburst shoulder and ankle guards, a serrated cloak back, and no fewer than 4 separate belts around his waist. Flanking him were a pair of Vagari in only slightly less gaudy robes, advisors or other underlings probably. Lining the walls were other Vagari, some in soldiers' armor, others in what seemed to be civilian clothing and simple face paint. All of them were gazing silently at the prisoner being brought before the throne. Cardass waited until the guards had positioned him 3 meters back from the throne, then bowed low. "I greet the great and mighty Vagari," he began in Minisiat, and was slammed to his hands and knees by a sharp blow across his shoulders.
"You do not speak in the presence of the Miskera until spoken to,"
one of the guards reproved him. Cardass opened his mouth to apologize, caught his near error just in time, and remained silent instead. For a long minute, the rest of the room was quiet too.
"Very good,"
a deep voice came from the dais at last.
"You may rise."
Carefully, tensing for another blow, Cardass stood up.
"I am the Miskera of the Vagari people,"
the Vagari seated on the throne announced.
"You will address me as your eminence. I'm told you have the insolence to demand that I bargain with you."
"I make no demands of any sort, your eminence," Cardass hastened to assure him. "Rather, I'm in terrible difficulty and came here hoping the great and mighty Vagari people might be willing to come to my assistance. In return for your aid, I hope to offer something you might find of equal value." The Miskera regarded him coolly.
"Tell me of this difficulty."
"My companions and I are merchants from a distant realm," Cardass told him. "Nearly 3 months ago, we lost our way and were taken captive by a race of beings known as the Chiss. We've been their prisoners ever since." A twitter of muted conversation ran around the room.
"Prisoners, you say?"
the Miskera repeated.
"I see no chains of captivity about your neck."
"My apparent freedom is an illusion, your eminence," Cardass said. "My companions are still in Chiss hands, as is our ship. Of equal importance, the Chiss now refuse to release to us some of the spoils of one of their raids. Spoils that we were promised, and that we need to pay off the late fees our customers will demand. Without the treasure, we will face certain death when we reach home."
"Where are your companions being held?"
"At a small base built deep inside an asteroid, your eminence," Cardass said. "The navigational data necessary to locate it is contained in the computer of the vessel in which I arrived."
"And how did you know how and where to find us?"
Cardass braced himself. "Because, your eminence, I was present aboard the Chiss attack cruiser that raided your forces here during your battle of conquest 5 weeks ago." A deadly silence settled over the room.
"You stole one of our shipnets,"
the Miskera said at last. "The commander of the Chiss force did that, yes," Cardass said. The Miskera smiled thinly.
"So you offer to trade your companions and some of our own treasure for nothing more than a chance at revenge?"
"You'd get your shipnet back too," Cardass offered.
"No,"
the Miskera said firmly.
"The offering is insufficient."
Cardass felt his throat tighten. "Your eminence, I beg you."
"Do not beg!"
The mascara snapped.
Crapspec! Inferior spec! Not beings who would speak and bargain with the Vagari. If you wish us to help you and your companions, you must find more to offer me.
But I have nothing more, Your Eminence. Cardas protested. I swear to you.
Not even those?
The mascara demanded, pointing over Cardas's shoulder. Cardas turned. Sometime during the conversation, someone had brought in 4 large crates, 2 of them a head taller than him, the others coming only up to his waist. What are those?
They were aboard your transport,
the mascara said suspiciously.
Do you claim ignorance of them?
I do, Your Eminence, Cardas insisted. I stole the vessel solely to come ask for your help. I never looked to see if there was anything aboard.
Then look now,
the mascara ordered.
Open the crates and tell me what you see.
Carefully, half expecting to be shot in the back, Cardas made his way back to the crates. The Vagari had already opened all of them, of course, merely setting the front panels loosely back into place. Stepping to one of the smaller boxes, he got a grip on the panel and pulled it off, and caught his breath. Inside, folded up neatly with their arms wrapped around their knees, were a pair of Trade Federation battle droids.
Do you recognize them?
The mascara asked. Yes, Your Eminence, Cardas confirmed. They're battle droids of a sort used by one of the species in our region of space. The commander also raided a force of those people. This must be part of the spoil of that raid.
What are droids?
Mechanical servants, Cardas said. Some are self-motivated, while others require a centralized computer to give them their instructions.
Show me how it works.
Cardas turned back to the crate, peering inside. There was no sign of a controller or programming console. I don't see the equipment I need to start it up, he said, stepping to the other small box and pulling off the front. There were 2 more folded battle droids inside, and again, no sign of a controller. Each of the 2 larger boxes turned out to contain one of the even deadlier Droidica destroyer droids. Still, no controller. I'm sorry, Your Eminence, but without the right equipment, I can't start them up.
Perhaps this would be of use,
the mascara suggested. He gestured, and one of the non-armored Vagari watching the proceedings pulled a data pad from beneath his robe. Stepping up to Cardas, he offered it to him. A small ripple of relief washed over some of Cardas's tension. Yes, Your Eminence, it will, he told the mascara as he looked over the controls. Activator, there. Shall I activate them now, Your Eminence?
Yes.
Bracing himself, Cardas pushed the switch. The result was all he could have hoped for. In perfect unison, the 4 battle droids unfolded themselves halfway, walked forward out of their crates, and then stood up, reaching back over their shoulders and drawing their blaster rifles. The droidicas were even more impressive, rolling forward out of their crates and unfolding into the tripedal battle stances. Around one of them, as if to demonstrate the full range of its capabilities, the faint haze of a shield appeared. And suddenly Cardas realized that there were 12 blasters pointed directly at the dais where the mascara was seated.
Impressive,
the mascara said calmly.
Who commands them?
At the moment, whoever is handling the controller, Your Eminence, Cardas said. But I think they can be programmed to obey a specific individual instead.
You will order them to obey me?
Yes, Your Eminence, Cardas said. I'll need you to come down here, though, so that the droids can see you up close. Silently, the mascara stood up and stalked down the steps, motioning his 2 advisors to stay where they were. He stepped between the 2 droidicas and stopped.
Do it now.
Feeling sweat collecting beneath his collar, Cardas ran through what he hoped was the proper procedure. The 6 droids turned slightly to face the mascara. Then, to his relief, the battle droids raised their blasters to point toward the ceiling, as the Droidica swiveled a few degrees to point their weapons away from him as well. "That should do it, Your Eminence," he said. "Of course, they won't be programmed to understand orders given in Minisiat."
"You will teach me the proper commands in their language,"
the Vagari said.
"The first command I wish to know is target. The second is fire."
"Yes, Your Eminence." Cardass gave him the two basic words, enunciating them carefully. "Perhaps your people can transcribe them phonetically for you," he suggested.
"No need,"
the Mascara said. He lifted a finger and pointed to Cardass.
"Target."
Cardass jerked backward as all six droids swiveled to point their blasters at him. "Your Eminence," he breathed.
"No,"
the Mascara said, his voice silky smooth.
"You pronounce the other word."
Cardass swallowed hard. If he'd done this wrong... "Fire," he said. Nothing happened.
"Excellent,"
the Mascara said approvingly.
"So you are indeed wise enough not to attempt a betrayal."
He lifted a hand.
"Bring me 3 Jeroons."
"Yes, Your Eminence,"
one of the soldiers acknowledged and left the room.
"Does your commander, Mithro Nuruodo, have more of these machines?"
the Mascara asked, turning back to Cardass. "Several hundred, at least," Cardass told him. "Possibly as many as several thousand." A movement at the door caught his eye, and he turned as 3 small aliens were herded into the room. "Who are these?"
"Slaves,"
the Mascara said offhandedly.
"Their pitiful little world is the one currently rolling beneath us. Machines, target."
Cardass stiffened as the droids swiveled toward the 3 slaves.
"Machines, fire."
The salvo from the battle droid's carbines sent the 3 slaves toppling backward, dead before they even hit the floor. They were still falling when the fire from the droidicas almost literally cut them in half.
"Excellent,"
the Mascara said into the shocked silence. Not shocked by the deaths, Cardass knew, but by the display of firepower.
"Where do the Chiss keep the others?"
"The commander will have them at the base," Cardass murmured mechanically, trying without success to force his eyes away from the charred bodies.
"Then we will relieve him of them,"
the Mascara said, gesturing to one of the advisors.
"Order an assault force to be prepared at once."
Outside the Spring Hawk's bridge canopy, the scattered stars and a small but magnificent globular cluster blazed brilliantly out of a black sky. The stars, the cluster, and nothing else. Surreptitiously, Doriana looked at his chrono. Outbound flight was late. Apparently, the look hadn't been surreptitious enough. "Patience, Master Doriana," Mithra Nuruodo said calmly from the captain's chair. "They will come."
"They are late,"
Vice Lord Cav said, scowling at the back of Mithra Nuruodo's head.
"More than 2 hours late."
2 hours is nothing in a voyage of 3 weeks," the commander pointed out reasonably. "The only question is whether or not this system is indeed on the correct straight-line path between their last Republic stop and the system where you were preparing to ambush them." And suddenly, with a flicker of pseudo-motion, there it was, floating in space not 5 kilometers ahead. Outbound flight had arrived. "The device is called a gravity projector," Mithra Nuruodo said. "It simulates a planetary mass, thus forcing out any ship whose hyperspace vector crosses its shadow."
"Really?" Doriana said, trying to sound calm.
To the best of his knowledge, no one in the Republic had ever figured out how to turn that particular bit of hyperspace theory into an actual working device. The fact that the Chiss had solved the problem sent discomforting ramifications ricocheting across his mind. Cav, predictably, wasn't nearly as interested in such long-term thought.
Then they are in our hands, he all but crowed. All forces, attack!
Hold, Mithranu Ruido said. I give orders aboard this ship, Vice Lord Cav.
It is our mission, Commander Mithrodo, Cav countered. And as we debate, we lose the precious element of surprise.
Fishing into his robes, he pulled out a comm activator.
You and your ships may do as you wish, but my starfighters will attack. No,
Doriana snapped, making a grab for the activator. But his reach was too short, his grab too late. Twisting his long arms out of range, Cav triumphantly keyed the activator. Swearing viciously, Doriana looked over at the asteroid where the lines of droid starfighters waited. Nothing happened. Again, Cav keyed the switch. Again, nothing.
I'm afraid that won't work, Vice Lord, Mithranu Ruido said calmly. I took the liberty of removing the alternate command layer your programmers had created in the starfighter's systems.
Slowly, Cav lowered the activator.
You are very clever, Commander. Someday, that cleverness will turn against you.
Perhaps, Mithranu Ruido said. Until then, allow me to thank you for showing me how such secondary programming is done. That will prove useful today.
So, what now?
Doriana asked cautiously.
We talk to them,
Mithranu Ruido said, keying his board.
Communications. Create a channel.
By the time Lorana arrived, D1's bridge had become a hive of quiet pandemonium. Sabaoth was standing beside Captain Pakmilu's command chair, his back stiff as he gazed out the canopy. Outside the canopy, arrayed in the distance in front of them like a pack of hunting howl runners, were a dozen small ships of a configuration Lorana had never seen before. The readback seems to indicate that we're in the middle of a planetary mass shadow, the engineering officer was saying tautly as Lorana reached Pakmilu's side. But you can see for yourself, that can't possibly be right.
This is Commander Mithranu Ruido of the Chiss Expansionary Defense Fleet.
A cultured voice boomed over the bridge speakers.
Please respond.
Who's that? Lorana asked.
The commander of that force over there,
Pakmilu rumbled, still studying the readouts.
He's been calling every 5 minutes for the past half hour.
You haven't answered him?
Master Sabaoth has forbidden it, Pakmilu growled. He insists we know what happened to our hyperdrive before we reply.
Lorana grimaced. Let me talk to him. Sabaoth was still gazing at the alien ships as Lorana joined him.
So, Jedi Jinsler, we meet our first challenge.
Why does it have to be a challenge? Lorana asked. Maybe all he wants to do is talk.
No, Sabaoth said. I can sense a deep malice out there. Malice directed at my ships and my people.
Command, this is Maning.
A voice came from the command chair speaker.
We're standing ready at D4's weapon systems.
Acknowledged, Sabaoth said. Dreadnought 4 was the last. Now we're ready to talk.
Deliberately, he lowered himself into Pakmilu's command chair and touched the comm switch.
Alien Force, this is Jedi Master Jorah Sabaoth, commanding the outbound flight project of the Galactic Republic.
Lorana looked back at Pakmilu, wincing to herself at Sabaoth's casual preemption of his command authority. But there was no resentment in the Mon Cal's expression or stance, only a quiet sense of resignation. Apparently, he'd bowed to the inevitable.
Master Sabaoth, this is Commander Mithranu Ruido,
the cultured voice replied promptly.
Let me see your face, Sabaoth ordered. There was a brief pause.
Then the comm display came to life, showing a near-human with blue skin and blue-black hair and glowing red eyes.
There are matters of great importance we need to discuss at once. Would you care to join me in my flagship, or shall I come to you?
Sabaoth snorted gently. I will discuss nothing until you stand away from my path.
And I will continue to hold here until we have spoken. Are the Jedi afraid of talk?
Sabaoth smiled thinly. The Jedi fear nothing, Commander. Come aboard, then, if you insist. A hatchway will be illuminated for your shuttle. Cardass had been waiting for nearly 3 hours before the Mascara again summoned him to the throne room.
All is prepared,
the Vagari informed him.
We fly at once to draw our vengeance from Mithron Nuruudo and the Chiss.
Yes, Your Eminence, Cardass said, bowing his head and trying not to look at the half-dozen fresh Jeroen bodies scattered around the throne room. Apparently, the Mascara had been playing some more with his new toys. I would once again ask you to remember that my companions and ship are also there, and would beg your soldiers to be careful.
I will remember,
the Mascara promised.
And I will do even more. I have decided you will be permitted the best view possible of the forthcoming battle.
Cardass felt something cold run through him. You mean I'll be on the bridge, Your Eminence?
Not at all. You will be in the forwardmost of my flagship's external bubbles.
Cardass looked sideways to see a pair of armored Vagari striding toward him. I don't understand, he protested. I've offered you the chance at both vengeance and profit.
Or the chance to fly into a trap,
the Mascara said, his voice suddenly icy.
Do you think me a fool, human? Do you think me so proud and rash that I would simply fly a task force to a supposedly small and undermanned Chiss base in my thirst for revenge?
5 minutes later, Cardass was pushed through a narrow doorway in the hull into a zero-G plastic bubble perhaps twice the size of a coffin. Set against the hull on one side of his head was what seemed to be a small air supply and filtering system, while on the other was a mesh bag containing a couple of water bottles and ration bars from the Chiss shuttle, along with a diamond-shaped device of unknown purpose. The fact that Mithron Nuruudo was a near-human this far from Republic space had been Lorana's first surprise. More surprising than that were the culture and refinement of his demeanor and speech as he spoke to her and Sabaoth from the other side of the conference room table. His reason for intercepting outbound flight was the biggest surprise of all, and the most chilling. Sabaoth predictably wasn't impressed by any of it.
Ridiculous! A mysterious species of conquerors moving across the galaxy toward us? Please. That's the sort of story bad parents frighten their children with.
You know everything there is to know about the universe, then? Mithron Nuruudo asked politely. I was under the impression that this region of space was unknown to you.
Yes, it is, Sabaoth said. But rumors and stories aren't limited by geographical and political boundaries. If a species so dangerous truly existed, we would surely have heard something about them by now.
Perhaps, Mithron Nuruudo said. But I didn't come here for an open debate. The fact remains that I cannot and will not permit you to continue on through this region of space. You must turn back to the Republic and pledge to never return.
Or?
Sabaoth challenged. Mithron Nuruudo's glowing red eyes were steady on him. Or I will be forced to destroy you. Lorana braced herself for the inevitable explosion. But Sabaoth merely smiled thinly.
So says the avian chick to the villainous dragon. Do you truly believe your 12 ships could survive 10 minutes against the firepower I hold here in my hand?
Mithron Nuruudo lifted his eyebrows politely.
Your personal hand? My Jedi are even now standing by in the Com-op center above us, as well as at the weapon stations of each individual dreadnought. Sabaoth said, I'll soon be joining them. And if you've never faced Jedi reflexes and insight, you'll find it a sobering experience.
Mithron Nuruudo's expression didn't change. Whatever their training, it will do them no good. Your only choices are to leave now and take your people home, or perish. What is your answer?
Abruptly, Sabaoth shoved back his chair and rose towering to his full height.
We are the Jedi, the ultimate power in the universe, he declared. We will do as we choose, and we will destroy any who dare stand in our way.
Lorana stared up at him, her heart suddenly pounding in her throat. What was he saying? What was he doing?
In that event, the conversation is over, Mithron Ruado said. His expression hadn't changed, but as Lorana tore her gaze from Sabaoth and looked at the commander, she could sense a hardening of his resolve that sent a fresh shiver up her back. I will give you an hour to consider my offer.
The pulsating hyperspace sky flowed past the Vagari warship, closer and more vivid and more terrifying than Cardass had ever seen it. With only a single layer of thin plastic between him and the waves, he couldn't shake the sensation that at any moment they might break through and snatch him away from even the precarious safety of his hull bubble, leaving him to die alone in the incomprehensible vastness of the universe. He tried closing his eyes or turning around so that his face would be to the hull, but somehow that just made it worse. And it would be a 6-hour journey back to the Krustai base. 6 hours of uncertainty and mental agony, along with the emotional strain of the hyperspace sky beating against his transparent coffin. Less than 2 hours after leaving the Jeroen homeworld, the hyperspace sky suddenly coalesced into star lines and collapsed back into stars. There was a click from somewhere beside him.
Human?
The mascara's voice snarled into his ear. Cardass jerked, banging his head on the cold plastic.
Human!
The voice came again. And this time he realized it was coming from the diamond-shaped device he'd puzzled at earlier. The Vagari version of a comlink, apparently. Reaching awkwardly over his shoulder, he grabbed it. Yes, Your Eminence.
What is this trap you have led us to?
I don't understand, Cardass protested. Did your people get the wrong coordinates from the transport's computer?
We have been brought too soon into crawl space,
the mascara bit out.
The stolen shipnet has been used against us.
Behind Cardass came the subtle clicking of locks as someone prepared to open his prison. But how could the Chiss have planned such a thing? He asked, fumbling to get the words out before the door could be opened. They must have been using it on someone else, and we just happened to run into it.
With all of space to choose from?
The mascara shot back.
Ridiculous!
Stranger things have happened, Cardass insisted. Behind him, the hull cracked open. Cardass tensed, but the Vagari outside merely thrust a set of macro binoculars from the Chiss shuttle into his hands.
Look forward,
the mascara's voice ordered.
Tell me the story of this vessel.
The door was slammed shut again behind him. Exhaling some of his tension, Cardass activated the macro binoculars and scanned the sky in front of him. The object of the mascara's interest wasn't hard to locate. It was a set of 6 ships, big ones, arranged around a cylindrical core with tapered ends. It was outbound flight. He took a careful breath. I've never seen anything like it. But it matches the description of a long-range exploration and colony project called Outbound Flight. There are 50,000 of my people aboard those ships, with enough supplies in the storage core to last all of them for several years.
How many fighting machines will they have?
I don't know, Cardass said. There'll be some, certainly. Mostly those bigger tripod-type droidicas to be used as colony boundary guards. Probably a few hundred of those. Most of their droids will be service and repair types, though. They probably have at least 20,000 of those types.
And these mechanical slaves will have the same artificial brains and mechanisms as the fighting machines?
Cardass grimaced. Yes. They could probably all be adapted to combat of some sort, he agreed.
But the people there aren't going to just hand them over to you. And those dreadnoughts pack a lot of firepower.
Your concern is touching,
the Mascara said, his voice thick with sarcasm.
But we are the Bagari. We take what we want.
There, Mithron Naruido said, pointing at the Springhawk's canopy.
You see them, Master Doriana?
They're a little hard to miss, Doriana ground out, his throat tight, as he gazed at the hundreds of alien ships that had suddenly appeared at the edge of Mithron Naruido's gravity field trap. Who the blazes are they?
A nomadic race of conquerors and destroyers, called the Vagari,
Mithron Naruido told him.
What are they doing here?
Cab demanded.
How did they find us?
I would imagine we have Cardass to thank for that,
Mithron Naruido said calmly. Doriana stared at the other.
You mean Cardass betrayed you?
Cardass has his own concerns and priorities.
Mithron Naruido lifted his eyebrows pointedly at Doriana.
As do we all.
They arrived quite suddenly.
Sabaoth's voice came from Lorana's comlink.
Some ploy of the Chiss, I imagine.
What are they doing? Lorana asked.
So far, just waiting. Captain Pak Milu informs me that their ship design is radically different from that of the Chiss, but of course, that means nothing.
Have you asked the commander about them? Lorana asked. Maybe they have nothing to do with him. Sabaoth snorted.
With all of space for them to fly through? Please.
He broke off as a melodious voice, or possibly two of them, began to speak in the background. What's that? Lorana asked.
They appear to be hailing us,
Sabaoth said. The alien voices grew louder as the Jedi Master moved closer to one of the bridge speakers. Lorana listened closely. It was a strange language, highly musical, with a distinct sing-song component to it. Master Sabaoth, she called. It doesn't sound like...
Go to Dreadnought 4 and report to Jedi Master Mening in the weapons blisters.
There was a click as he shut off his comlink. Lorana sighed. Yes, Master Sabaoth. They're probably not answering because they don't understand you, Cardass explained as patiently as his pounding heart would allow. As I said, they're from the same region of space I am, and we don't know the language of the mighty and noble Vagari.
You will soon learn it,
the Mascara promised him coldly.
In the meantime, you will serve as translator.
Cardass grimaced. Of course, Your Eminence.
Of course,
the Mascara said.
Tell me first, how deeply within the vessels will the fighting machines be stored? Will they be at the surfaces, or deeper inside?
Deep inside, Cardass told him.
Good,
the Mascara said with satisfaction.
Then we may destroy as we will without risking our prize.
An unpleasant sensation tingled across Cardass's skin.
Now, speak this. You of the vessel known as Outbound Flight. We are the Vagari. You will surrender or be destroyed.
Or be destroyed.
Lorana looked across the weapons blister at Mening, at the tight set to his mouth. The first voice from the unknown ships had definitely not been human. This one, just as definitely, was. And the human had been speaking basic as well. This wasn't good. A captive from the Republic? She suggested.
Or a traitor,
Mening said grimly.
Either way, it's going to make this that much trickier.
Not at all.
Sabaoth's voice came from the comm speaker.
There's nothing even a traitor could have told them that will have prepared them for the kind of coordinated defense a Jedi Meld can offer.
With 100 or more warships at their disposal, I can't see them worrying overly much about how tight our defense is,
Mening countered.
Patience, Master Mening.
Sabaoth said, his voice glacially calm.
Trust in the Force.
They're moving forward,
Captain Pakmilu's voice cut in.
All weapon stations, stand ready.
Lorana took a deep breath as she stretched out to the Force for strength and calm. This was it. The first genuine test of the Jedi control system Sabaoth had spent so much of his time teaching the rest of them.
What in the name?
Abruptly, Maning hunched closer to his sensor displays.
Master Sabaoth!
I see them,
Sabaoth said.
So this is the sort of enemy we face.
What is it?
Lorana asked.
Look at the warships, Maning said. See all those plastic bubbles on the hulls.
Lorana felt her chest tighten.
There are people in there.
Living shields,
Sabaoth confirmed, his voice thick with contempt.
The most evil and cowardly defense concept ever created.
What do we do?
Lorana asked, a sudden trembling in her voice.
We can't just slaughter them.
Courage, Jedi Jinsler,
Sabaoth said.
We'll simply shoot between the hostages.
They make no answer,
the Mascara said accusingly, as if outbound flight silence was Cardass's fault.
Perhaps they're still consulting among themselves, Your Eminence,
Cardass suggested. The Vagari ships had started to close the gap between themselves and outbound flight, moving together into groups of tight formation clusters that would provide them the protection of overlapping forward shields.
You will give them a new message,
the Mascara ordered.
The time for discussion is ended. You will surrender now, or...
And in the middle of the sentence, his voice abruptly dissolved into a confused burbling. Cardass frowned, pressing the comm link to his ear. The whole bridge seemed to have collapsed into the same helpless babbling, as if the entire crew had had a mass mental attack. Which was, he suspected, exactly what had happened. He looked out again at outbound flight, an unpleasant shiver running through him. He'd heard the stories about all the ways Jedi could use their mind control tricks to confuse attackers. Everything from creating false noises in their ears to making them unable to properly focus on controls or weapon systems. But while the stories also claimed that a group of them together could use that power on this massive a scale, he'd never heard of something like that actually happening. Until now.
So your tales were correct, Mithron Naruado murmured. Your Jedi have reached across the distance to the Vagari and numbed or destroyed their minds.
So it would seem, Doriana agreed, feeling a little numb himself. Predictably, it was Cav who broke the awed silence first.
And our part is to sit by and do nothing?
He prompted.
Our part is to do that for which we have come,
Mithron Naruado said. Reaching to his board, he keyed a switch.
It is time for the Vagari to die.
The Vagari?
Cav echoed.
No! You were given my starfighters for use against outbound flight!
I was not given the starfighters at all,
Mithron Naruado corrected him coolly. Ahead, the droid starfighters were rising in waves now from their asteroid staging area, heading at full speed toward the clusters of Vagari warships.
I will choose how to use them.
Cav snarled something in his own language.
You will not get away with this,
he bit out.
Walk cautiously, Vice Lord,
Mithron Naruado warned, his glowing eyes flashing at the Nymordian.
Don't forget that the starfighters aren't the only Nymordian technology I've taken from you.
Doriana felt a sudden tingling on the back of his neck. He spun around, expecting to find the two droidicas Mithron Naruado had taken from the Dark Venge standing behind them in full combat stance. But there was nothing there.
No, Master Doriana, the combat droids are not here,
Mithron Naruado assured him.
They're where they can be of far more useful service.
And where is that? Doriana asked.
Where else?
Mithron Naruto said, smiling tightly. On the bridge of the Vagari flagship. The sudden multiple stutter of blaster fire in his ear sent Cardass twitching to the side, and he banged his elbow against the edge of the bubble as he hastily moved the comlink farther away. His head was still ringing as the rhythmic fire of the droidicas was joined by the more deliberate shots from the four battle droids' rifles. Apparently, Thrawn had had a secondary control pattern laid in beneath the program Cardass had set up earlier for the mascara. The sounds of shooting shifted subtly as the six droids began to move across the bridge, mowing down the helpless gunners and commanders. And as they systematically chopped off the head of the Vagari leadership hierarchy, the droid starfighters arrived. The first and second waves flashed overhead without slowing, skimming the hull barely 5 meters from Cardass's face as they drove toward the clusters of Vagari ships in the distance. The third wave arrived in full combat mode, their laser cannons raking the flagship with a brilliant sheet of fire. Cardass flinched back, but almost before he had time to be frightened, they too were passed, leaving torn pieces of shattered hull material and white jets of escaping air in their wake. Blinking against the multiple purple afterimages, he peered through the dissipating gases at the other bubbles around him, half afraid of what he would see. But the starfighters had pulled it off. In every single one of the bubbles within his view, the Jeroen hostages were still alive. Terrified, certainly, some of them clawing mindlessly at the plastic as if trying to tunnel their way out. But they were alive. With outbound flight's Jedi preventing the Vagari gunners from defending their ships, and with the sharp-edged precision the droids' electronic targeting systems and close-approach attack had permitted, the starfighters had sliced their way neatly through the warship's hull between the Vagari's living shields. And not just aboard the flagship. All around him, Cardass could see clouds of debris and escaping air enveloping the other nearby Vagari warships, the haze scintillating with the fiery glow of the starfighters' drives as they finished each set of targets and moved on to the next. Already in this first attack, he estimated Thrawn's assault had taken out over a quarter of the alien warships. And still with no response from the remainder. The question now, he knew, was whether the Jedi control of the aliens would last long enough for the starfighters to finish the job. Switching on his macro binoculars, listening with half an ear to the one-sided carnage still going on beneath them on the bridge, he focused on outbound flight. Beside Doriana, Mithron Nuruodo took a deep breath. Chatra, he ordered. And moving as a single unit, the Chiss fleet surged forward. Time to join the party? Doriana asked, still watching in grim amazement as the waves of droid starfighters methodically cut their way across the Vagari ships. No, Mithron Nuruodo said. Time to start one of our own. And it was only then that Doriana saw that the Springhawk and the rest of the Chiss ships were heading for outbound flight. He closed his hands into fists, waiting tensely for the Dreadnought's gunners to spot this new threat and open fire. But nothing happened. The Springhawk flew completely through the turbolaser's effective combat range, passed unchallenged through the point defense zone, and with only minor turbulence, passed through the shields near the bow of the nearest Dreadnought. The other Chiss ships broke from the Springhawk's flanks, spreading out toward the other dreadnoughts as the Springhawk curved from its intercept vector to fly low across its chosen dreadnought's hull and opened fire. They hit the weapons blisters first, the brilliant blue fire of the Chiss lasers tearing through armor and capacitors and charging equipment and digging deeply into the blisters themselves. The shield generators were next. The Springhawk zigzagging along the Dreadnought's hull as it targeted and destroyed each in turn. All done with the utmost efficiency, a small detached part of Doriana's mind noted, without a single wasted movement. Clearly, Mithron Naruodo had made good use of the technical readouts he'd provided. And then, to his surprise, the Springhawk made a sharp turn away from the hull and headed again for deep space. Beyond the expanding cloud of destruction, he could see the other Chiss ships doing the same.
"What's wrong?" he asked.
"Nothing is wrong," Mithra Naruudo said.
"Why?" "But you have ceased the attack,"
Cav said, clearly as bewildered as Doriana.
"Yet they lie helpless before you."
"Which is precisely why I've stopped," Mithra Naruudo said.
"Jedi Master Sebaeth, leaders of outbound flight, your vessel has been disarmed, its ability to defend itself destroyed. I offer you this one final chance to surrender and return to the Republic."
"What?"
Cav yelped.
"But you were to destroy them!"
"If and when you should command again, Vice Lord Cav, such decisions will be yours," Mithra Naruudo said coolly. "But not now.
Outbound flight, I await your decision."
Through the echoing haze of dying minds still screaming at her, through the smoke and debris and distant moans of the injured, Lorana realized she was dying. Probably from suffocation, she decided, as she noticed that her lungs were straining, but that little or no air was reaching them. She tried to move, but her legs seemed pinned somehow to the deck. She tried to stretch out to the Force, but with the death agonies of the Vagari now joined by the much closer deaths of her own shipmates, she couldn't seem to bring her thoughts into focus. Something cold and metallic closed around her wrist. She opened her eyes to find a maintenance droid tugging at her arm.
"What are you doing?"
she croaked. It was a matter of mild surprise to discover that she had enough air even to speak. Experimentally, she tried to take a deep breath, and felt a welcome coolness as air flowed into her lungs. She blinked away some of the fog hazing her eyes and peered through the swirling debris. There was a long, jagged slash through the ceiling above her, undoubtedly the source of the weapon's blister's sudden decompression. Stretched across the gash were a dozen sheets of twisted metal that appeared to have been blown or pulled away from the walls. Half a dozen small metalwork droids were climbing across them, filling the room with clouds of sparks as they hastily welded the sheets into place over the gash. Lying on the deck halfway across the room, his arm stretching toward the ceiling as he used the Force to hold the still unwelded sheets in place, was Mening. Lorana couldn't see very much of his body with the wreckage of the control room scattered across her line of sight, but she could see enough to turn her stomach. He must have caught the full brunt of one of the laser blasts, taking both the agony of the shot itself, as well as the impact of the shards of shattered metal it had created.
"Master Mening!"
she gasped, trying to get up, but her legs still refused to work.
"No, don't!"
Mening said. His voice was strained, but still carried the full authority of a Jedi Master.
"It's too late for me.
For..." Lorana broke off, a sudden edge of horror cutting through her. With the attack and her own near suffocation, she'd completely lost her connection to the Jedi meld that had so successfully blocked the Vagari attack. Now, as she tried to stretch out to it again, she found that it had all but vanished.
"No,"
she whispered to herself, but there was no mistake. When their attackers had targeted the weapons blisters, they had knowingly or unknowingly targeted the Jedi as well. And with only one or two dazed and stunned exceptions, they were dead. All of them.
"I should have tried stop him sooner,"
Mening murmured, his voice weakening as he rapidly lost strength.
"But he was Jedi Master. Jedi Master."
With an effort, Lorana pushed back the paralyzing horror.
"Don't talk," she said, trying again to move. "Let me help you." "No,"
Mening said.
"Too late for me."
"But I can't just leave you,"
Lorana protested. Again she tried to get up, and this time she succeeded.
"I am far beyond your help,"
Mening said, a deep sadness in his voice.
"Go. Help those who can still be helped. But...
no!
Maning bit out, his face convulsing with a sudden spasm.
You're... Jedi! Take an oath! Serve others! Go! Go!
Lorana swallowed. Yes, Master. I... She trailed off searching for the right words, but there weren't any. Perhaps Maning couldn't find any either.
Goodbye, Jedi Jinsler,
he simply said, a ghostly smile touching his lips. Goodbye, Master Maning. Maning's smile vanished, and he lifted his eyes again to the repair droids and their work. Turning away, Lorana picked her way through the wreckage toward the door. She knew she would never see him again.
We made a bargain, Cav snarled. You were to destroy outbound flight for us.
I never made any such bargain, Mithron Naruido said. I agreed only to do what I deemed necessary to eliminate the threat posed by the expedition.
That was not what we wanted,
Cav insisted. You were in no position to make demands, Mithron Naruido reminded him. Nor are you now.
There was a sudden hiss from the comm.
So?
An almost unrecognizable voice ground out.
You think you've won, alien?
The display came alive, and a cold shiver ran up Doriana's back. It was Joris Sabaeth, pale and disheveled, his clothing torn and blood-spattered, one side of his face badly burned. But his eyes blazed with the same arrogant fire that Doriana had seen that day long ago in Supreme Chancellor Palpatine's office. He groped for Mithron Naruido's sleeve. Cav is right. You have to destroy them. If you don't, we're dead. Mithron Naruido's eyes flicked to him, then back to the comm.
I have indeed won. I have only to give a single order.
His hand shifted slightly on his control board, his fingertips coming to rest on a covered switch edged in red.
And you, and all your people, will die. Is your pride worth so much to you?
A Jedi does not yield to pride,
Sabaeth spat.
Nor does he yield to empty threats. He follows only the dictates of his own destiny.
Then choose your destiny, Mithron Naruido said. I'm told the role of the Jedi is to serve and defend.
You were told wrongly,
Sabaeth countered.
The role of the Jedi is to lead and guide, and to destroy all threats.
The unburned corner of his lip twisted upward in a bitter smile. And without warning, Thrawn's head jerked back, his whole body pressing back against his seat. His hand darted to his throat, clutching uselessly at it.
Commander!
Doriana snapped, grabbing reflexively for Mithron Naruido's collar. But it was no use. The invisible power that was choking the life out of him wasn't something physical that Doriana might be able to push aside. Sabaeth was using the Force, and there was nothing Doriana or anyone else could do to stop him. In a handful of minutes, Mithron Naruido would be dead. Lorana was in a turbolift car heading down the forward pylon when she felt Sabaeth's attack echoing through her mind like the sound of a distant hammer. For a minute she puzzled at it, sensing his anger and frustration and pride, wondering what in the world he was doing. And then abruptly, the horrifying truth sliced through her like the blade of a lightsaber.
No!
She shouted reflexively toward the turbolift car ceiling. Master Sabaeth, no! But it was too late. In his single-minded thirst for revenge, Joris Sabaeth, Jedi Master, had gone over to the dark side. The bridge crew was on it in a matter of seconds, shoving Doriana roughly aside and clustering around Mithron Naruido as they fought to free him from the unseen attack that was killing him.
But their efforts were as useless as Doriana's had been. Standing at the edge of the frantic activity, Doriana looked at the comm display and tried desperately to think. If the Chiss attack had weakened Sabaoth enough, but there was no sign of weakness in the eyes blazing from that ruined face. Could Doriana shut off the display then, and at least rob the Jedi of his view of his victim? But Doriana had no idea where that control was, and he didn't speak any language the rest of the bridge crew understood. Besides, he wasn't sure that cutting off the display would do any good anyway. And then, his gaze dropped from Sabaoth's face to Thrawn's control board, the board and the red-rimmed switch. It might be nothing, but it was all he had. Pushing past the crewers who stood in his way, he flipped back the cover and pressed the switch. And then, even as they continued to pound mercilessly against the Vagari warships, the droid starfighters abruptly turned from their attack and fled. Cardass frowned, pressing the macro binoculars tighter against his face. A sizable percentage of the Vagari fleet was still untouched, the surviving ships scrambling madly for the edge of Thrawn's gravity projector field. Yet all of the starfighters were leaving. Had they drained their solid fuel engines already? He caught his breath. No, the starfighters weren't running away from the Vagari. They were running toward outbound flight. He was still staring in disbelief when the first wave hit. Not simply attacking, blasting away with laser cannons and energy torpedoes. They literally hit the dreadnoughts, slamming at full speed into their hulls and vaporizing in brilliant flashes with the force of their impacts. The second wave did the same, this group striking different sections of the dreadnought's hulls. Through the smoke and debris came the third and fourth waves, these groups pouring laser cannon fire and energy torpedoes into the damaged weapons blisters and shield generators. And with a sudden chill, Cardass understood. The first two waves of starfighters hadn't been trying to breach the dreadnought's thick armor plating. Their goal had merely been to create dents in the hulls at very specific points. The points where the interior blast doors were positioned. And now, with those doors disabled or warped enough to prevent a proper air seal, the rest of the starfighters were opening the dreadnoughts to space. More clouds of debris were blowing away from outbound flight's flanks as the starfighters blasted their way through the hulls, sweeping new waves of sudden death through the outer areas of the dreadnoughts. But for all the effect the attack had on him, Sabaoth might not even have noticed it. His face remained as hard as anvil stone, his eyes burning unblinkingly across the Springhawk's bridge. And Mithron Naruado was still dying. Doriana curled his hands into helpless fists. So it was finally over. If this second assault had failed to kill Sabaoth, it was because he'd hidden himself well away from the vacuum that had now snuffed out all life in the dreadnought's outer sections. Even given the thinner bulkheads and blast doors of the ship's interior sections, there was no way even droid starfighters could clear out the maze of decks and compartments in time. An odd formation caught his eye as it shot into view outside the canopy. A pair of starfighters flying in close formation with a fat cylinder tucked between them. Not just one pair, Doriana saw now, but 10 of them, heading at full speed toward outbound flight. He remembered Cav mentioning this particular project of Mithron Naruado's and the Vice Lord's contemptuous dismissal of the cylinders as some sort of useless fuel tanks. Frowning, he watched as in ones and twos the starfighter pairs drove through the newly blasted holes in the dreadnought's hulls and disappeared inside. For a moment, nothing happened. Then, abruptly, a haze of pale blue burst outward from the openings, nearly invisible amid the floating clouds of wreckage. And with a sudden gasp of air, Mithron Naruado collapsed forward against his board.
"Commander!" Doriana called, trying to get past the circle of crewers. "I'm all right."
Mithra Naruto panted, rubbing his throat with one hand as he waved off assistance with the other.
I think you got him,
Doriana said, looking over at the comm display. Sabaoth was no longer in sight.
I think Sabaoth's dead.
Yes,
Mithra Naruto confirmed, his voice quiet.
All of them are dead.
A strange sensation crept up Doriana's back. That's impossible, he said. You only had one or two of those bombs in each dreadnought.
One was all that was necessary,
Mithra Naruto said with a sadness that Doriana had never heard in him before.
They're a very special sort of weapon. A very terrible sort. Once inside the protective barrier of a war vessel's outer armor, they explode into a killing wave of radiation. The wave passes through floors and walls and ceilings, destroying all life.
Doriana swallowed.
And you had them all ready to go.
Mithra Naruto's eyes bored into his.
They were not meant for outbound flight, he said.
And there was an expression on his face that made Doriana take an involuntary step backward.
They were intended for use against the largest of the Vagari war vessels.
Doriana grimaced.
I see.
No, you do not see,
Mithra Naruto retorted.
Because now, instead, we'll need to destroy the Vagari remnant aboard the disabled vessels in shipboard face-to-face combat.
He pointed out the canopy.
Worse, some of the war vessels and civilian craft have now escaped to deep space, where they'll have time to rebuild, and perhaps one day will again pose a threat to this region of space.
The battle had been over for nearly 3 hours, and Cardass was starting to get seriously bored when he finally heard the rhythmic tapping at his back. He half turned over and wrapped the same pattern with the edge of the macro binoculars. Then, turning back around to face the stars, he worked the kinks out of his muscles and waited. It came in a sudden flurry of activity. Behind him, the door to his prison popped open, and he felt the sudden tugging of vacuum at his lungs and face as the air pressure in his bubble exploded outward, shoving him backward out into the corridor. He caught a glimpse of vac-suited figures surrounding him as he was enveloped in a tangle of sticky cloth. Before he could do more than scrabble his fingertips against it in an effort to push it away from his face, there was a harsh hissing in his ears, and the cloth receded from him in all directions. And a moment later, he found himself floating inside a transparent rescue ball.
Whoa!
He muttered, wincing as his ears popped painfully with the returning air pressure.
Are you all right?
A familiar voice asked from a comlink connected to the ball's oxygen tank.
Yes, Commander. Thank you, he assured the other. I gather it all worked as planned?
Yes,
Thrawn confirmed, his voice carrying an odd tinge of sadness to it.
For the most part.
One of the other rescuers leaned close, and to his surprise, Cardass saw that it was the human who'd introduced himself aboard the Dark Venge as Commander Stratus.
Cardass,
Stratus demanded.
What are you doing here? Luring the Vagari into my trap, of course,
Thrawn said, as if it were obvious.
Or had you forgotten that the Chiss do not engage in preemptive attacks?
I see,
Stratus said, still eyeing Cardass.
So those spy accusations you were throwing around aboard the Dark Venge were nothing but smoke. Something to cover you in case the whole thing fell apart. It was protection, yes, but not for me,
Thrawn said. He gestured, and the rest of the group began maneuvering Cardass's rescue ball down the corridor.
It was to protect Admiral Ar-Alani, the officer commanding the transport that arrived an hour ago to take the free Jerun slaves back to their world, and who couldn't afford to be even unofficially involved in any of this,
Stratus said, nodding.
But who could make sure to look the other way at all the right times, leaving you and Cardass to take the blame if anything went wrong.
Never mind the blame, Cardass put in. What happened with outbound flight? I saw the starfighters take off after it. Thrawn and Stratus exchanged looks.
We were forced to go farther than I'd hoped,
Thrawn said.
Cardas felt his heart freeze in his chest. How much farther?
They're dead,
Thrawn said quietly.
All of them.
There was a long silence.
There wasn't any choice,
Stratus said into his numbness.
Sabaoth was using his Jedi power to try and strangle the commander. There was no other way to stop him.
Did you ever give them the chance to just leave and go home? Cardas retorted.
Yes,
Thrawn said.
More than just one chance,
Stratus added.
More than I would have offered them, in fact. And if it matters any, I was the one who actually pushed the button.
Cardas grimaced. You're sure there aren't any survivors?
The dreadnoughts were taken out by radiation bombs,
Stratus told him.
We haven't actually sent anyone over yet to check, but if the commander's weapon stats are accurate, there's no way anyone could have lived through that.
So you got what you wanted after all, Cardas said, feeling suddenly very tired. You must be happy. Stratus looked away.
I'm content, he said. I wouldn't say I'm happy.
The rescued Droons had been herded into the cargo bay, the only place aboard the transport big enough to hold them all. Standing to the side, just inside one of the bay doors, trying to stay out of the way of both the Droons and the Chiss crewers moving about them, Cardas looked out at the multitude, his heart and mind fatigued beyond anything he'd ever experienced.
Even now, they don't seem to believe it,
a voice murmured from his left. Cardas opened his eyes. Thras was standing beside him, a strange expression on his face as he gazed across the crowded bay.
Syndic Thras, Cardas greeted him. I didn't realize you were aboard.
Admiral Ar-Alani suggested I come,
Thras said, his eyes still on the Droons.
She seemed to think she and I and my brother could now resolve the question of the Vagari goods being held at Krustai and allow you and your companions to go on your way.
He turned his eyes onto Cardas.
Now that you and I have apparently served our purposes.
Cardas held his gaze without flinching. I have no problems with having been a part of your brother's plan, he said evenly. Neither should you.
I was manipulated and controlled, Thras said.
For your own protection, Cardas countered. If Thrawn and Ar-Alani had brought you into the plan, your future would have been just as much on the line as theirs were.
And as they are now,
Thras pointed out darkly.
The 9 ruling families will not stand for such an illegal and immoral attack.
Number 1, Cardas said, lifting a finger. This system is within the patrol region of the Chiss expansionary fleet. That makes it Chiss territory. Number 2, the Vagari arrived in force with the clear intent of causing harm. That makes Commander Thrawn's action self-defense, as far as I'm concerned.
They were here only because you had so enticed them.
I'm not bound by your rules, Cardas reminded him. Besides, as Admiral Ar-Alani will attest, your brother had publicly labeled me as a possible spy. If I got desperate enough to go to the Vagari for help in freeing my companions, you can hardly blame that on him.
Thras's lip twisted.
No, Thrawn has always been very good at hiding his hand when he wishes to do so.
Which seems to me takes care of the legal aspects, Cardas concluded.
As to your other objection, he gestured toward the Droons.
I defy you to look at these people and tell me how freeing them from tyranny could possibly be immoral.
The morality of an action is not determined by the results,
Thras said stiffly. His face softened a little.
Still, in this case, it's a hard point to argue.
I saw the way the Vagari treated their slaves, Cardas said, shivering at the memories of the Droons the Mascara had murdered in cold blood. In my opinion, the universe is well rid of them.
I would tend to agree, Thras said. But Aristocrat Chafbor Bintrano may not see things so clearly.
Cardas frowned. What does he have to do with anything?
He and vessels of the 5th ruling family are on their way here, Thras said grimly. I had a brief communication with him just before leaving Krustai. I suspect he intends to place Thrawn under arrest.
Cardas felt his throat tighten.
Does Thrawn know about this?
No.
We need to tell him. And fast, Cardass said grimly. Do you know where he is?
I believe he and Admiral Ar-Alani have gone across to inspect outbound flight.
Then let's get over there, Cardass said. Come on. My shuttle's in one of the portside docking stations.
They found Thrawn and Ar-Alani on the bridge of the main command ship, standing amid a bustling crowd of Chiss crewers, methodically checking out the still-active control consoles. There were a lot of bodies there, too, lying haphazardly all over the deck. For once, Cardass hardly even noticed.
Ah, my brother, Thrawn said, as Thrass and Cardass made their way through the maze of consoles. Are the Jeroons being properly cared for?
Never mind the Jeroons, Cardass put in before Thrass could answer. Aristocrats reformed Bintrano's on his way with a fleet of Fifth Family ships.
On whose authority do they fly?
Ar-Alani demanded.
The Aristocrats' own, I presume, Thrawn said. His eyes narrowed in thought. How soon until they arrive?
They could be here at any time, Thrass said. I suspect he's coming to raise charges against you.
In that case, he would hardly need a fleet of vessels,
Thrawn pointed out.
No, the Aristocra has something far more profitable in mind.
Outbound flight? Cardass asked.
Actually, I expect he's hoping to take possession of the remains of the Vagari fleet, Thrawn said. But you're right. Once he sees outbound flight, that priority will definitely change.
He can't do that, Thrass protested.
He looked at Ar-Alani.
Can he?
Not legally,
Ar-Alani said, her voice tight.
But as a practical matter, if he's brought enough vessels, there'll be no way for us to stop him.
The Council of Families, Thrass began,
will certainly object, Ar-Alani cut in. But the procedure will be long and complex. And in the meantime, the Fifth Family will be coaxing the secrets from their new prize, Thrawn said.
Thrass hissed, a startlingly reptilian sound.
We can't allow that, he said. Possession of outbound flight by any one family could destroy the balance of power for decades to come.
Cardass nodded, a hard knot forming in his stomach. The thought of getting their hands on droid technology alone had been enough to lure the Vagari to their destruction. How much more of an edge would the droids plus the rest of Outbound Flight's technology give Chaform Bintrano's family?
We'll have to stall him, Ar-Alani said. We must keep his people off this vessel until the defense fleet units I've summoned can arrive.
They won't be in time, Thrawn said.
We need to take Outbound Flight to a military base immediately and have it declared defense fleet property.
How long a trip are we talking about? Cardass asked dubiously. This thing's taken a lot of damage.
It will push the systems to their limit, Thrawn conceded. But we must try. It would be better for outbound flight to be destroyed than to let any single family claim it.
There was a flicker of movement at the corner of Cardass's eye. He turned to the canopy. Just as the last of a dozen large Chiss ships came out of hyperspace.
Too late. He's here.
Ar-Alani muttered a word that had never come up in Cardass's language lessons.
We'll have to make do with the crewers you already have aboard, she said. Quickly! Before!
She broke off at a twitter from Thrawn's comlink. Thrawn looked out at the ships, then reluctantly pulled the device from his belt.
Commander Mithran Nuruodo.
Commander, Aristocrat Chafar Bintrano of the Fifth Ruling Family is signaling the Springhawk. He demands your immediate presence aboard the Chaff Exalted.
Thrawn's eyes flicked to Ar-Alani.
Do not acknowledge his signal, he ordered.
It was not a request, Commander.
Do not acknowledge, Thrawn repeated, and clicked off the comlink.
Thrawn, you can't simply refuse an Aristocrat's direct order,
Thrass objected.
I haven't yet received any direct orders from the Aristocrat, Thrawn said evenly.
Cardass, find me the helm.
Yes, sir, Cardass said, peering at the nearest consoles. And then Ar-Alani's comlink twittered. All eyes turned to her.
Clever.
was all she said as she removed it from her belt and keyed it on. Admiral Ar-Alani.
This is Aristokrat Chafar Bintrano. I've been unable to contact Commander Mithron Nuruodo, and I suspect he's refusing to communicate with me. As an aristocrat of the fifth ruling family, I order you to find and detain him pending a hearing on his recent military activities.
Ar-Alani hesitated, and Kardas held his breath. Then, with clear reluctance, she nodded. Acknowledged, aristocrat. I hear and obey. She shut off the comlink. I'm sorry, Commander, she said to Thrawn. I have no choice but to place you under detention. This will destroy the Chiss, Thrawn said quietly. The defense fleet, and only the defense fleet, can safely take possession of this vessel. I understand, and I'll do what I can to stall the aristocrat, Ar-Alani said. But in the meantime, you are under detention. Order your people to assemble in the hangar to return to our vessels. For a long moment, Thrawn stood motionless. Then, slowly, he bowed his head and activated his comlink. This is Commander Mithran Nuruodo, he said. All Chiss warriors aboard outbound flight. Return to the hangar bay. Thank you, Ar-Alani said. Now, if you please, she added, gesturing back toward the blast doors. You too, Kardas. Kardas took a deep breath. I'm not under Chiss command, Admiral, he said. I'd like to stay aboard a while longer. Ar-Alani's eyes narrowed. What are you planning? Surely you can't fly this vessel alone. I'm not under Chiss command, Kardas repeated, and the aristocrat's order didn't mention me. Ar-Alani looked at Thrawn, then at the incoming fifth family ships, then finally back at Kardas. Permission granted, she said. She started toward the blast doors. I'll also stay, Thras said. Ar-Alani stopped in mid-step. What? I'm also not under Chiss military command, Thras said. And Aristokrat Chafform Bintrano didn't mention me either. Ar-Alani sent a hard look at Thrawn. We'll both be destroyed by this, she warned. The role of a warrior is to protect the Chiss people, Thrawn reminded her. The warrior's own survival is of only secondary importance. For half a dozen heartbeats, the two of them locked gazes. Then, with a hissing sigh, Ar-Alani turned to Thras. Pes Favri is the nearest defense fleet base. You know the coordinates. Thras nodded. Yes. Then we leave you, she said, nodding to him. May warrior's fortune smile on your efforts. She continued toward the blast doors. Thrawn lingered for a last long look at his brother, then followed. And a minute later, Kardas and Thras were alone. You really think we can get this thing all the way to a military base? Kardas asked. You miss the point, friend Kardas. Thras said grimly. Weren't you listening to my brother? It would be better for outbound flight to be destroyed than to let any single family claim it. Kardas felt a sudden tightening in his throat. Wait a second, he protested. I was just going to try to lock outbound flight down so that the aristocrat's people couldn't get aboard without blasting their way in. I didn't sign up for a suicide mission. Courage, Kardas. Thras assured him. Neither did I. I assume we can set this vessel's course to intersect the local sun, then escape in the shuttle we arrived in. Kardas thought it over. I think so. Then let us do it, Thras said. Your people built this vessel. Tell me what to do. The turbo lift shaft was reasonably clear, and the car reached D4 with only a few bumps and scrapes. The dreadnought itself didn't seem too badly damaged either, except, of course, for all the bodies. The medical droids had already started clearing them away, probably taking them all to one of the medical labs, where, according to the droids' now outdated programming, living beings would be waiting to give orders on how to proceed. But there was no one to receive the corpses. Lorana stretched out with the Force and worked with the ship's comm system, hoping, against all her fears, that someone might have miraculously survived the cataclysm that had overtaken outbound flight. But no one answered either call. D4, it seemed, was dead. Of defenders and attackers alike. And that, Lorana found both curious and ominous. Surely the Chiss hadn't gone to all the effort to destroy outbound flight, simply to abandon it. But then, where were they? She spent only a little time on D4 before continuing on. The turbo lift to D3 was inoperable, implying damage to the cars or the pylon or both, so she headed instead to D5. There she picked her way through the same debris and bodies, and received the same negative result to her efforts at communication. D6, the next ship on her grisly tour, was much the same. Still, all three ships seemed to be mostly airtight again, with adequate light and heat and gravitation. The service droids had used the past few hours well. If the Chiss truly had abandoned outbound flight, she and the others might be able to make it at least partially operational again. She was in the turbo lift heading for D1 when her senses caught the faint whisper of nearby life. She pressed her head against the wall of the car, stretching out with the Force as best her own injuries and lingering horror would allow. There were definitely living beings out there. Alien beings, and not very many of them. But at least there was someone. And she and her turbolift car were headed straight toward them. The door opened in front of him, and with a not very gentle nudge at the small of his back, the pair of yellow-clad Chiss gestured Doriana forward. He found himself on a command bridge, similar to the one aboard the Springhawk, only bigger and crewed exclusively by Chiss in the same yellow uniforms as his escort. It made Mithron Nuruodo's black uniforms stand out that much more in contrast as he stood in the center of the room before a Chiss in a gray and yellow robe. Behind Mithron Nuruodo, a female Chiss, dressed all in white, stood at stiff attention. The robed Chiss eyed Doriana as his escort again nudged him forward. He spat something in the Chiss language. "So this is your collaborator," Mithron Nuruodo translated. "Hardly," Doriana said, loading his voice with as much dignity and disdain as he could, just in case the robed Chiss was able to pick up on verbal cues. He had no idea the details, but it was obvious that there was some kind of power struggle going on here. And Kinman Doriana, assistant to Supreme Chancellor Palpatine, was quite familiar with power struggles. "I'm an ambassador of a vast assembly of star systems called the Galactic Republic. I came here on a mission of goodwill and exploration." He studied the robed Chiss carefully, as Mithron Ruodo translated, but the other merely smiled cynically and spoke again. "You came to bring chaos and war to this region of space," Mithron Ruodo translated. "You have brought alien weapons that you intended to use against the Chiss ascendancy." The robed Chiss straightened slightly as Mithron Nuruodo finished and spoke again. "But you have failed. Those weapons are now the property of the fifth ruling family. I, Aristokra Chafform Bintrano, hereby take possession." Doriana nodded to himself. So it was outbound flight and its technology that was at issue here. And he knew enough about internecine conflict to know that letting one Chiss group have sole possession of it would probably create terrible conflict with the other groups, up to, and possibly including, civil war. Which would of course be precisely the situation Darth Sidious would want to see here. A Chiss ascendancy, entangled with its own internal problems, couldn't pose a threat to the Sith Lord's plans for the Republic and the new order he planned to create. Standing here in the middle of Aristokra Chafform Bintrano's people, all Doriana had to do was confirm the Fifth Family's claim, and he would help with the Chiss on that long and bitter road. But as he opened his mouth to speak, He looked at Mithron Uruodo. The commander was looking back at him, his face expressionless, his glowing eyes focused unblinkingly on him. I'm sorry, Aristocrat Chaform Bintrano, but outbound flight is not yours to take possession of, Doriana said. As a duly appointed representative of the Republic that sent the project on its journey, I claim full salvage rights. Chaform Bintrano seemed taken aback as Mithron Uruodo finished the translation. He bit something out. Ridiculous, Mithron Uruodo said. An aggressor has no rights. I deny your claim that either I or outbound flight have behaved aggressively toward your people, Doriana countered. And I demand a full hearing and judgment before any Chiss steps aboard outbound flight. Mithron Uruodo translated. Chaform Bintrano's eyes narrowed, his glare shifting to the white-clad female. He said something, she replied, and the argument was on. Doriana looked sideways at Mithron Uruodo. His face was still expressionless, but as his own eyes shifted to meet Doriana's, his lips seemed to twitch upward in a microscopic smile of approval. Just what the commander would do with the mess that had now been stirred up, Doriana didn't know, but to his mild surprise, he discovered he was rather looking forward to finding out. It had taken longer than Cardas had expected to get outbound flight prepped for flight, but at last they were ready. Okay, get to the helm, he told Thras, glancing out the canopy at the Chiss ships still hovering in the near distance. Why they hadn't already sent over a boarding party, he couldn't guess. Apparently, Thrawn and Ar'alani had found a way to stall them. Ready? Thras called. Stepping to the navigation console, Cardas gave it one final check. Course set and locked in, ready to take outbound flight on its final voyage. Crossing to the engineering console, he settled his fingers on the power feed controls. Watch out! Thras snapped. Cardas spun around, expecting to see a whole squad of yellow-suited Chiss charging in on them. But to his astonishment, he found himself facing a lone female human. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Thras snatch a weapon out of concealment in his robe. In reply, the woman produced a short metal cylinder, and a green lightsaber blade blazed into existence. No! He barked, waving a hand frantically at Thras. But it was too late. The other's weapon hissed out a blue bolt, which the woman sent ricocheting harmlessly into the ceiling. I said stop! Cardas called again. She's a Jedi! To his relief, Thras didn't fire again. What do you want? The Chiss demanded instead. He wants to know what you want, Cardas said, translating the Cha'oon for her. Her eyes flicked to him. He doesn't speak basic? No, Cardas said. But he knows some Sibisti if that helps. It does. She looked back at Thras. Who are you? She asked, switching to that language. I am Syndic Mith Thras Safis, of the 8th ruling family of the Chiss Ascendancy. Thras identified himself. And I'm Georges Cardas, Cardas added. Who are you? Lorana Jinsler, she said. Her eyes flicked across the dead bodies, and an edge of fresh pain crossed her face. Who else is aboard? At the moment, just us, Thras said. He hesitated, then slipped his weapon back into his tunic. But a member of one of the ruling families is trying to claim outbound flight for himself. We're trying to prevent that. Jinsler's eyes narrowed. How? We're going to have to scuttle it, Cardas said, watching her face carefully. Even with nothing left but torn and broken metal, there was an even chance she would be attached enough to the Hulk to object violently to its destruction. People went all weird like that sometimes. Sure enough, her eyes widened. No, she insisted. I can fly outbound flight. By yourself? Thras asked in clear disbelief. One single person? One single Jedi, Jinsler corrected him. Master Sebaeth insisted we all learn to handle all of the major systems. At least, under normal conditions.
The conditions here are hardly normal, Cardas pointed out. And it still leaves the question of where we go.
We'll never make it back to the Republic, not with this much damage.
Any idea what other habitable worlds there might be out there?
Even if I did, I would caution against anything nearby, Thras said. This region is dangerous, with pirates and privateers all around.
Not to mention what's left of the Vagari, Cardas agreed with a shiver.
Come on, Thras, think. There has to be something else we can do.
Thras gazed out at the Fifth Family ships.
There's one other possibility, he said slowly. Within 2 days' flight is a star cluster that the defense fleet has begun to fortify as an emergency refuge. I've seen the data, and there are at least 10 habitable worlds within it that haven't yet been explored.
Kind of an out-of-the-way homestead, Cardas pointed out doubtfully.
And still in Chiss space, Jinsler added.
But it's a place where vessels of the Fifth Family wouldn't accidentally discover you, Thras said. Only Defense Fleet personnel go inside, and only to specific systems as they work on the fortifications.
So what's the catch? Cardas asked.
Thras made a face. The catch is that I don't have the safe access routes into the cluster. Are your navigational systems capable of finding such routes on their own?
Probably not, Jinsler said. But I might be able to. There are Jedi navigational techniques that should be good enough to take us through even a star cluster.
So what happens if she can? Cardas asked Thras. I return and negotiate in secret with the Council of Families for your safe passage home, Thras said, then looked at Jinsler.
There are other hyper-capable vessels aboard that I could use, are there not?
Just one. A 2-passenger Delta 12 Sky Sprite, Jinsler said. But it should have the range you need.
So that's it? Cardas asked. We hide outbound flight in this cluster, negotiate a deal with the Chiss, all the Chiss, and everyone gets what they want?
Basically. Jinsler hesitated. But the we won't include you. For a long moment, she held his eyes.
You'd better go then, she said. Good luck.
He looked to Thras.
To both of you.
10 minutes later, Cardas eased the Chiss shuttle out of the dreadnought's hangar and flew it clear. Turning the nose toward the waiting Fifth Family ships, he looked back over his shoulder at the magnificent failure that had been outbound flight. He wondered if anyone would ever see it again.
For a moment, Thras and Lorana stood silently. Then, taking a deep breath, Thras released her hand.
Then let us bring this part of history to a close, he said briskly.
May warrior's fortune smile on our efforts.
Yes, Lorana said. And may the Force be with us.
This is Jonathan Davis. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Star Wars Outbound Flight by Timothy Zahn. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Jacob Bronstein. Star Wars Outbound Flight is a production of Lucasfilm Limited. Copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music master production, copyright 2006, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House Audio presentation. All rights reserved.